I'm James Bayes at UN headquarters in New York. Norway and the United States have long been close allies, but with other NATO partners, they're now facing a new challenge as the alliance puts its forces on alert. And with thousands of Russian troops amassed at Ukraine's borders, are we heading into a full-scale war? Meanwhile, as Norway ends its presidency of the UN Security Council, it's now facilitated closed-door discussions between Taliban leaders, Afghan civil society, and international diplomats. So how will Oslo tackle these and other pressing global issues moving forward? The Norwegian Prime Minister, Jonas Gahr Støre, talks to Al Jazeera. Jonas Gahr Støre, Prime Minister of Norway, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera. And I'm going to start with a question that, for you, calls for pure speculation, because already it's been answered by others. US President Joe Biden thinks the answer is a likely yes. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres thinks it's probably no. So I want your view. Do you think Russian President Vladimir Putin is going to decide to invade Ukraine?
It's in his head, and I cannot read his mind. But I choose to say no, because I think the options other than military intervention should be available to modern Europe. We have a toolbox in Europe that should be able to deal with these kind of issues, provide security to countries next to other countries without using the military option, which I believe is not an answer to the challenge.
Norway is currently midway through its two-year term as an elected member of the UN Security Council. You've been president of the Security Council for the month of January. Do you believe that the threat of an invasion of Ukraine is currently the biggest threat to international peace and security?
Well, in the immediate weeks to come, I believe yes. But that does not mean that one can push aside other threats to security in other regions of the world. And I'm always, you know, conscious of saying that there are threats to peace and security that don't appear on the TV screens, that happen where there are no cameras. And this is an intense conflict. It is dangerous. It is military. There is full observation. But there are also wars going on around in the world, you know, causing suffering of people that we don't cover. But I agree, it is a serious challenge, and it should be dealt with politically by responsible leaders.
Let's look at what Russia has said. Russia says it wants new treaties with NATO and the US. It says it wants to protect its sphere of influence. It says that NATO has been expanding where it shouldn't. And it says that Ukraine should never join the NATO alliance. Why are these demands so unacceptable to the West?
Well, it's almost like a shopping list. And, you know, when you go to a shop, you don't find all the goods when you go around looking for them. But nations and states in Europe should be able to be secure, feel secure, and interact with each other. It is the right of countries to choose their security alignment. I believe that NATO membership to new countries which have come during the 90s and up until recently has happened among democratic states in a democratic fashion. As I see it, membership of Ukraine in NATO is not on the agenda as of today. But Russia is marking, you know, its interest in a way which is now expressed by military means, by this huge mobilization. And I take the point again that providing security for one state next to another state, confidence-building measures, securing that there are not offensive weapons threatening my security or your security, all these issues can be dealt with politically. Disarmament on tactical nuclear weapons in Europe, a number of issues that we should deal with politically. And the fact that now we have this dialogue between the US and Russia, there is NATO-Russia dialogue, that's the channel. We have to deal with these issues and find solutions among diplomats and leaders.
You've said just now that the membership of Ukraine isn't on the table anytime soon. Back in 2008, Ukraine was told by NATO, yes, one day you can become a member. Why don't NATO countries and the US now give a tangible concession to Russia? Why don't they say, for example, Ukraine won't be joining in 10 years, perhaps 20 years?
Well, I will not go into it. I'm not present at that table where these talks take place. I simply note that, you know, that was 2008 there hasn't been a change for a number of reasons since then, and it is not on the immediate agenda or on the agenda of NATO countries. But it's not for a third country outside to determine, you know, what security arrangements other countries should take. Norway became member of NATO in 1949. That was our decision to anchor our security in the, as a democracy, in the Euro-Atlantic cooperation. I think that's an important principle for NATO to say that, you know, this is not for outside countries to determine. That being said, Europe has an arrangement of securing states that you can live secure next to another state without feeling threatened or intimidated. And we deal with that in negotiations and in political processes. Firm on principles, but also open to talk and find solutions politically.
You said a short time ago that it was unacceptable for Putin to come up with a shopping list. And he must have known that he wasn't going to get all those things on that list. What do you think Putin really wants? What's his strategy right now?
Well, I mean, if I could tell, I could come on many more talk shows than this one. But, you know, let me take a Norwegian perspective. We are neighbors with Russia. Norway has been in peace with Russia for 1,000 years. We have 200 kilometers land border and a huge responsibility together in the Barents Sea and the Arctic Sea. We had a disputed border with Russia in these waters. And I negotiated with my colleague Sergei Lavrov a modern treaty to solve that issue. We demonstrated that we could share 170,000 square kilometers, 50-50 to each state, with a very modern principle of drawing a delimitation line. We have developed neighbor relations with Russia in the north, which I believe are pointing in the future direction. You know, politically, neighbors can deal with each other and find solutions. So we have to get back to that track where my security is not impeding on your security. And Europe has a toolbox that we can use, and that's the avenue we should go down. And which should also comfort the president and the leadership and the people of Russia, that they too are secure in this European political family.
So given Norway's experience as a neighbour, Norway's international experience as a mediator, are you giving that sort of advice to fellow NATO members, and particularly to the US right now? Because you're saying there's a way to deal with this.
Well, but I mean, we have a lot of experience, and the experience is different. You know, being neighbor with Russia is not a one solution. I mean, they are neighbors to Russia with a different story, different history. And I respect that. And when I talk to my Baltic colleagues, my Polish colleague, my Nordic colleagues, we all have different experiences. But our experience is the one I bring to the table. But, you know, it's an experience of being secure also because we are in an alliance. We are next to Russia. We deal with our neighbourhood in a low-tension fashion. But Russia knows that Norway's policy is predictable and long-term. We are a member of NATO. We are a solidarity member of with our allies, and we take our obligations seriously. That gives stability and is in no way a threat to our neighbour Russia in the north.
As you know, there is so much speculation now. Will there be a full invasion? Will he just take the Donbass? Is he going to use agents provocateurs? Is there going to be a puppet political figure? Are there going to be renewed cyber attacks? How does NATO calibrate its response to so many different possibilities at this stage?
Well, I think NATO's voice has to be clear. Our kind of collective defence reassurances concerns NATO members. But we cannot be indifferent if there is military force being used to cross borders against states in Europe in 2022. That is unacceptable. So I'm also very clear, you know, that if military means on a massive scale or military means at all is used to cross border and pressure other countries, we should be very clear about that. It's not acceptable. It will have consequences. And that should be stated clearly. And I have experienced now that the United States, talking to Russia, has been very inclusive with its European partners. It's a very united NATO now, very united Euro-Atlantic voice on these key principles. But on that basis, I still believe that the political track provides us with opportunities to find solution, reassurances. And that's also up to now President Putin to demonstrate that he can be at that table seeking solutions that can be constructive, not only for him, but also for his neighbours.
You say it's united, yet there are some NATO countries, for example, the UK, the Baltic states, and now the US, that are sending weapons and equipment. They're sending anti-tank missiles, Javelin missiles, and Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. Other countries, like Germany, are saying, no, we're blocking the transfer of weapons. And France is arguing that perhaps it's the EU, not the US, that should be negotiating with Russia. Aren't these sort of divisions, and there are some divisions, just going to embolden President Putin?
I don't call them the divisions. You know, it may be look different from the other side, but these are democracies. You know, there are debates going on. But on the key principles, you had discussions among key allies in NATO, US, France, Germany, European Union, and on these key principles, there is agreement. NATO has to, you know, follow developments, look after our most exposed countries who feel insecurity in these weeks, and reassure them. And here, I think, you know, the Russian president has a responsibility himself. You know, does he contribute to reassurances, to stability, to the environment it takes to find political solutions? I simply state, and I observe, that now there are talks going on. There's a channel of communication. And I would appeal to those who sit at those tables, use those channels at the maximum. And on the NATO side and the Euro-Atlantic side, I believe there is very strong unity on the principles and very clear messages in the communication.
We've been talking about Russia in what it maintains as its sphere of influence. But Russia has been involved in lots of other arenas in recent years. They possibly, you could argue, turned the tide in the war in Syria. There have been Russian mercenaries, the Wagner Company, active in Libya, Sudan, Central African Republic, Mozambique and Mali. Do these deployments concern you?
They do concern me because I believe that, you know, they are, you know, you mentioned several different theatres of conflict here. But I think there's a characteristic about modern conflict that there are many proxy wars going on, you know, many external actors who are there with different interests, and also in the military hardware. And in an isolated way, you may say that that's a way a country, this time Russia, can promote its interest. What I observe is that, you know, it normally leads to a lot of suffering, prolongment of conflicts. Conflicts are not allowed to be found, you know, to find solution that can settle things, take care of humanitarian needs, look after civilians in conflict. So I think that's a worrying sign of modern conflict, that you have these semi-state-wise military interventions. It's not a good sign.
Let's add into the discussion another superpower, which is arguably much more powerful than Russia, and that's China with its Belt and Road Initiative. Let me ask you about China and Russia. Do you see their relationship as just pragmatic, or is this growing into quite a strong alliance?
I think a bit of both. You know, I think historically, if you look at it, you know, from back from the time of Nixon and Mao, when you had kind of alignment between China and the United States, then there was the Soviet Union. Now one could argue that China and Russia are finding together on a number of issues to make a point towards the United States. In the long historic perspective, I think, you know, the full story has not been told yet. You know, where is the commonality of interest? Where does it really take place? From my perspective, you know, being in New York next to the United Nations and the Security Council, I mean, we have to appeal to these major players that they take their responsibilities as being big states and of finding solutions, sitting down, using diplomacy, not to make divisions, but also try to find some solution to some of the really pressing issues we have. If it is a closer China-Russian relationship based on energy, raw materials, a number of these issues, well, be it. Can we have enough momentum to deal with climate change, some of the global challenges that will really require common action by these major states at the table? That's where I would like to push, you know, to see that they deliver on the short term.
And do you think a potential conflict in Ukraine could bleed into some of those issues, like climate change, like, for example, the Iran nuclear deal? Talks go on in Vienna, but you know that China wants the oil from Iran, and only last week the Iranian president was having very cordial meetings with President Putin.
Well, obviously, a major military conflict in Europe around Ukraine will have vast implications in many directions. For Russia, it will have serious implications, but also for all activity and transactions around in the region and beyond the region, it will have consequences. War has consequences, and it is setting us all back.
Right now, China is focused, I know, on the Beijing Winter Olympics, which are about to start. But is there a nightmare scenario going forward that Russia goes into Ukraine and then China decides to go for Taiwan?
I think war is a nightmare scenario. You cannot pressure other countries with military threats, as we see now, for example, in Europe.
How much is democracy under threat right now around the world? Because we've seen a spate of coups. The UN's called it an epidemic of coups in places just in the last couple of years. Mali, Sudan, Myanmar, and just now in Burkina Faso.
Well, that's a big question. You know, I think the most important part of securing democracy is that democracies themselves do not deteriorate from inside. You know, we have to protect democratic institutions in democracies. And then we have to see to it that, you know, democracy is not something which is a given. It has to be, protected, and protected primarily by democratic elected leaders responding to the needs of their populations. You know, in situations where people live in dire circumstances, if there's military conflict or if there's environmental depletion or lack of resources, you come closer to the point when democracy loses out, and you get these coups, and which are major setbacks for people.
We've talked about how Russia and China might see divisions in the West and in NATO. Perhaps we haven't spoken about what could be Exhibit A in that, and that's last August, the humiliating withdrawal of the West from Afghanistan. Let me ask you about that. Did the international community, NATO countries like your own country, Norway, and the US in particular, let down the people of Afghanistan?
Well, to me, you know, as a foreign minister and going in and out of Afghanistan, it was obvious, you know, from 10, 15 years earlier that, you know, there was not going to be a military solution to that conflict. This had to be settled by Afghans. And I think when history is coming back to judge us, far too little effort was made into creating political processes among Afghans. It happened gradually, you know, during the last decade, but a lot of time and a lot of resources and a lot of lives were lost because this process was too slow. The end of that military presence, I think, would have been messy, no matter how you had arranged it, frankly speaking. The way it did happen was very messy. And, of course, I think it surprised the whole world, not least the Taliban, to all of a sudden see that, you know, they were in control of the country without any battle. So the question now is, you know, how can we, who have been in Afghanistan, basically to secure regional peace and stability, avoid another terrorist state developing. Now that we are out militarily, I think we still should have our focus on how to avoid this to sink into a deep humanitarian crisis with perhaps another migration crisis and yet another fertile ground for global terror.
So how do you stop that humanitarian crisis? Is it not time to unlock Afghanistan's reserves, and don't Western countries, particularly the US, have a moral duty to do so at this point?
Well, I believe we have a moral duty to move forward. And, you know, in all international relations, you deal with those who are in charge normally. You don't agree with them. You don't share values. You don't fund them. And you may be tough with them, but you deal with them.
That's why you've invited the Taliban. They've been in Oslo for talks, I guess.
And exactly, no recognition of Taliban, no money to Taliban, no free ride for Taliban. They are in charge. So what we have done, they have not come to Norway to talk to Norway. They have come to Norway basically to talk to Afghans. So we have brought to Oslo civil society representatives from inside Afghanistan and from outside Afghanistan to Oslo. And for the first time, they are sitting with Taliban at a sufficient level that conversations can be, you know, meaningful, reflect real issues.
But Prime Minister, you know how controversial this is. Some people, and I used to live in Afghanistan and follow a lot of Afghans on social media, they say you're rewarding the Taliban at a time when half the Afghan population, the country's women, live under virtual house arrest.
Well, I mean, they have now met with Afghans. They have met with the US, with France, with Europeans, with the UN, and with Norway. To me, it looks like this. If we don't sit down with them, present the expectation, the demands, and what they have to deliver, Afghanistan is going to sink down in a tremendous humanitarian disaster. 1 million children may starve. 10 million people are in need of food aid from outside without starving. And it's an economy completely, you know, disrupted. So things have to start by Afghans dealing with Afghanistan, and we, the international community, have to find meaningful inroads to avoid that catastrophe, which is bad for the Afghans, but you can have another migration disaster for the neighbors and for the rest of the world, and you may have another fertile ground for terror.
In 2008, when you were your country's foreign minister, you visited Afghanistan. You went a number of times, but on this occasion, you were staying in the Serena Hotel in Kabul when it came under Taliban attack. A Norwegian journalist who was part of your party died in that attack. So I'd like your personal perspective. Yes, you've launched these talks, but how do you feel personally, given the Taliban tried to kill you?
It is not an easy thing to see that, you know, Taliban is landing on Norwegian soil. So then comes the question. Is my trouble with this, is my anguish with what we experience then, is that going to block the opportunity of seeing Afghans sit down and deal with each other to avoid that major disaster? And my conclusion is that no, it cannot be the thing that really blocks that opportunity.
So Norway carrying out talks with the Taliban right now. Rewind 30 years, and very important talks were started by Norway almost 30 years ago that led to the Oslo Accords. Can I ask you where we are now with regard to Israelis and Palestinians? Because it appears that the viable two-state solution you are working towards is actually dead.
I believe, you know, until there is a viable Palestinian state living next door to Israel in security, there will not be stability in the broader Middle East. I believe still that the Oslo Accords, although you may say Oslo is dead, it still has the blueprint on how you can move forward. My point here, as we are in January 2022, this is a process that cannot be simply forgotten. And it's up to really the parties primarily, but also the international community. And I believe the US has to focus on this to get some process going.
Because well, not for, your, for your presidency of the Security Council, you called a meeting at foreign minister
yes.
level. Very important, one would think, and I know there's COVID, but out of the 15 Security Council members, only Norway and Ghana sent their foreign ministers. The world and the US don't seem to care.
Well, but that's why we should take the opportunity when we are sitting in the Security Council of reminding the Council and thereby the rest of the world that, you know, we cannot forget this.
Isn't there one part of this that no one ever talks about in the international community? And that's that this conflict will never be solved while the US has all of its public and political opinion stacked on one side, on the side of the Israelis?
Well, that's on one argument about American politics. I think, you know, the broader interest should demonstrate
Well, they're the most
that,
powerful
yeah,
country in terms of delivering a solution.
Clearly, but, you know, we have then to, you know, the parties themselves, Israelis and Palestinians, they have to put their process in order. And then I believe, you know, for the international community around should be facilitating and supporting towards something which is more sustainable than the situation we have now, which is pretty dire for the Palestinians, and thereby, you know, not securing security and interests of Israel.
You talked about your experience, and we talked about Norway's peacemaking in Afghanistan and in Israel-Palestine, but I could add Colombia, Sri Lanka, Sudan and South Sudan. Why does a country with just 5 million people want to perform this outsized role on the international stage?
My expression is that in a world of today, Norway is what I would call a political and economic surplus nation in a world of enormous deficits. So if we can use some of our opportunities to make a difference, be it here at the UN or some conflict where we have contacts and trust, it's our obligation to try.
But it's a really difficult job, isn't it? And a very bleak picture. If you look back to your time as foreign minister, you were foreign minister until 2012. That's a decade ago. And nearly all the conflicts you were dealing with then, whether you look at the Democratic Republic of Congo, Mali, Syria, Libya, they're all still there. And yet on top of that, in the last year or so, we have Myanmar, we have Ethiopia. It's a really bleak picture.
Depressing. So what do we do about that? You know, do we close the door and go home, or do we try to make an effort to make a difference where it's possible? I believe, you know, one should not be cynical and give up. You know, there is hope, there are opportunities, and basically if we come back to the core, how can we secure people decent lives, avoid humanitarian disasters? There's a lot we can do. And we should not give up, and in certain of these processes you described, Norway has an intake that, that makes it possible to make that difference, and we should try.
Jonas Gahr Støre, Prime Minister of Norway, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
Thank you.